This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do.
Today's guest will be of great interest, certainly to parents, but I suspect to mostly all of you. I am very pleased to introduce to you Barbara Dianis. She is the founder of Dianis Education. Barbara Dianis, welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, Barbara, I'm going to start off with being personal, because I'm okay with that. I hope you are too.
Absolutely.
Okay. You clearly, by the name of your company, it's clear that you work in the field of education. And you came to this, it seems like, after having had your own challenges as you were a little one in school. Can you tell us about that?
I certainly can. When I was in school, starting even as in kindergarten, it was evident that I wasn't keeping pace with my peers, even though I appeared like I was, you know, had normal intelligence, but I was falling behind even in the early reading skills, and I continued on into my first grade year. And by the time I was in second grade, around Christmas or December of second grade, I was referred to the University of Minnesota to have some educational testing done. And I went through, my parents signed me up for that, and I went through 2.5 days, almost 3 days worth of educational testing, and they determined that I had dyslexia. And when that occurred, there really wasn't much to do for students that had dyslexia. And they, you know, assured me that I was bright, but I would struggle in school. And school was not a place I ever really wanted to struggle. I come from a long line of educators on my mother's side of the family, and I have some college professors and doctors. And also my grandmother was a middle school English teacher for over 35 years. So education was very important. And so I was, you know, wondering, how am I going to learn and be able to keep pace with my peers, which was a major goal of mine at that time period, even being a small child.
Now, let me ask you this. You received this diagnosis of dyslexia in what grade?
Second. I was 7 years old.
Did you have any idea what that meant?
Well, I knew that I wasn't keeping pace. I knew that I was working hard on my papers, and I was coming back with everything wrong, see me, and, you know, all marked up, and I knew all of that. So I didn't understand entirely what it meant. The doctors did try to explain it to me, you know, as a 7-year-old.
Sure.
But I understood that I was, you know, there was a problem here, and I wasn't learning at the same level as my peers in class.
For those listening who may not be entirely clear about what dyslexia actually looks like, can you define it for us now?
Absolutely. It is the inability to make sense out of written symbols, and then there's all these meanings, other meanings attached along with it. So therefore, like when I would read, I might see things backwards, where I might see was as saw as was, or I'd transpose letters within a word, or sometimes the words jumped around the page, but not very often with me. But some of the kids, the words, they'll describe the words are literally moving on the page. And therefore, it is very difficult to learn to read.
Of course.
And so reading and spelling was also very, very hard for me as a child.
So here you are at 7 years old, and you've got this, for a 7-year-old, somewhat complicated diagnosis, and already you have a goal to be a part of, you know, certainly to be a good student, and you're now told that you're just going to struggle throughout
right.
your lifetime. How did that impact you as you moved through school?
It really did, because I knew I was bright. And I knew I was working as hard as the other students in my classes, and I wasn't attaining the same rewards. So I really decided I had to really do something for myself, because I was, during that time period, the only program we really had is they taught the sight words and sent you on your way. Well, there's, you know, so much more beyond, you know, learning sight words is great, but there's so much learning beyond sight words that in areas that would impact me. So
now when you say sight words, what does that mean?
The sight words, that is the words that don't follow any type of phonetic rules that you just have to learn how to spell, like was, and then like should, would, could, thought.
Okay.
All of those words.
Okay.
And so what I did was I would be constantly checking in with my grandmother. She wasn't local, but she would send me ideas. And I put myself on reading programs.
You put yourself on reading programs.
I did.
You were determined.
I did. I decided after my second grade year, I made my mother take me to the library and the first week of summer, and I picked out like 9 different chapter books that I decided I was going to read that were in my reading, you know, grade level reading. And my grandmother sent me a junior dictionary and told me that, and a notebook, and said, you know, any word you come to in your reading and you don't know it, look it up and use the phonetic spelling and then make yourself a reading list to work with of the words you don't know. And by the time I finished the last book and went back to school, the teachers were amazed at how much I'd improved in my reading and wanted to know what reading program I'd been in.
Well, I'm just amazed that at that age, you were so bound and determined.
I was a determined child. I did not like seeing all those low grades on my papers. It was embarrassing.
People in general may find themselves with a diagnosis, and rather than be relieved that at least they understand what's going on, are very often really demoralized almost by the fact
of... Just a second. Can we just do a quick break here?
Sure.
A second.
All right, I'm just going to ask you that question again.
Okay.
So often when people get a diagnosis, rather than being relieved that they have an understanding of what's going on, which is what many people report, but just as many people actually feel defeated by it and sort of hopeless. Again, it's just sort of stunning that you, as such a little one, you know, took the tactic that this was not going to beat you, that you were going to manage this and keep moving forward. What can you say to people who are listening now, who may just have gotten a diagnosis and are just kind of struggling with the fact of the diagnosis?
What I can say to them is, for one, first thing, understand that if you have average intelligence, you have the capacity to learn. It may be more difficult, you may need different strategies, but you still have the capacity to learn. And it only really takes one person to believe in you. My grandmother kept inspiring me and telling me every day, you know, when she would talk to me or write me letters saying, you are smart, you can do this. And because she was a middle school teacher and had been for so many years, that helped me to believe in myself. And she used to say, well, I've taught other students who struggled. You know, we don't know what it was and why they struggled, because at that time period they didn't have any diagnoses when she first started teaching. But she said, you know, these students made it with some extra help, and you can too. And I think that was so important to me to hear a positive that I could make it too.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's just kind of important across the board, particularly for children, but certainly for people in general, to know that there's at least somebody who believes in you and is really supportive of your efforts. All right. So let's sort of slide through school. You got through school, high school, and then college.
Right. And in high school, even at my very beginning years of high school, I was still struggling. I would go along and be okay in one area and then slide in another. And so it took me until the beginning of my junior year of high school to never struggle again in school. So I was constantly having to change up my test-taking skills, change up different skills that I was implementing on study and homework skills that didn't work. So I would have to reassess what is working for me, what isn't. And so that was a big process, and by the time I graduated, I was almost a straight-A student, but I was highly determined to be one. And then I went on to college, and I felt a duty, if I could get through this and master my own dyslexia and become academically where the student I wanted to be, I felt I had techniques. I needed to share that with others and not just keep it to myself. So I went on and studied and and then graduating education, special education, master's degrees in special education and psychometry, which is testing and diagnosing. And I became a part of the National Dean's List, which to me is still something I'm very proud of, because that is something through my early years of schooling, even into my junior high years, would have really looked impossible for me to ever achieve.
And, it just sounds, again, like you worked so hard, you were so determined. But the theme that I hear through all of this is that you realized that you had a goal. The goal was important to you to achieve, and you kept at it until you achieved it, and you did.
That is absolutely correct. And that's the same type of determination I instilled in my students, to believe in themselves, have goals, and keep working and changing the methods that aren't working for you until you do achieve that goal. And understanding that, yes, it might be harder. You might have to study longer periods of time and implement all kinds of different study techniques than your peers, but it will be worth it in the end.
Well, tell us about the formation of Diana's Education. When did that come into being?
Well, that's been in place since July of 2007 under that name. But I always, when I started teaching, I've taught pre-K all the way through 12th grade kids, and I had my own tutoring business and really worked with so many different kids from different economics and walks of life in different school systems, and my techniques were working for them, and I was so happy to see the kids achieve way beyond what the doctor's diagnosis said and way beyond the conferences with the psychologists and every other type of meetings that we had. And I was so happy to see them start to really pull out of their learning issues and start achieving at the level they wanted to and reach their academic potential. And my students were then able to do well in their SATs and ACTs. They went to whatever colleges they wanted to go to, and they graduated and did fine. And so I really wanted to take that and share it with the world and let the world know that kids with diagnoses such as ADD, dyslexia, ADHD, if they have normal to average to average and above intelligence, they can learn and they can have academic dreams come true for them, and they can achieve academic goals. And that's where Diana's Education came about.
And, another thing that you continue to point out to us, which I think is so important, is that having a diagnosis that impairs with your learning doesn't mean that you can't learn. It simply means that you
Right.
learn differently. It doesn't mean
Right.
you're not smart. It doesn't mean you're not intelligent.
Absolutely, and that's a key idea that students themselves have to realize again, and sometimes parents and teachers, because everyone gets so caught up or can get caught up in the diagnosis and where the student is right now and how much they're struggling. And so, therefore, like with my students, I would just say, I know you're really struggling now, but that doesn't mean you can't have some semesters coming up that you won't struggle as much in, and as you learn some new techniques, you can start achieving. And that to the students really was something like the light turned on, that I don't always have to be working this hard mm-hmm. and not doing as well and having the papers come back to me that I don't, with grades I don't want. Because what I found out with my teaching, very few students are happy with not performing at least as well as their peers or not above, and having those low grades and working hard and it's not feeling like they are rewarded for their work.
One of the things that I also think it's important to understand is for many parents, there are certainly parents who don't understand what's going on if their child appears to have a learning disability and will often decide the child's just not paying attention. I put that in quotes, or, is just quote unquote lazy or just doesn't want to bother. And it's so critical if you believe that your child, or if you yourself believe that you're having a learning challenge, rather than blaming and shaming, take the time to find out what that's all about, because there's a reason for it.
Absolutely. Most students, when I would really talk to the kids, whether they were young children or they were high schoolers, they would say to me, it's easier for me to have my parent believe or my parents believe, depending on what their home situation was, that I can't, that I don't want to do something, that I'm really just not wanting to do this math problem, my math homework, than to believe I can't do it, that this is really hard for me. Because it really gets into the student's pride.
Right.
And then the parent thinks, well, the reason they're not doing as well is that maybe they are lazy, and sometimes you do have some unmotivated kids. But you really have to take a look at it, and that's what I encourage parents to do. Take a full look at the picture. Has this been an area this particular student has always struggled in, or, you know, not done as well as other kids? Are they putting, you know, work into it? Are they doing their homework? And if they are really falling behind, do they really need to look into having some testing done by the school system?
And again, even the child who's not, quote-unquote, not motivated, there's a reason. Or there may be a couple of reasons, but there's a reason. And it's important to dig until you can get at what that reason is. Now, somewhere along the way, somewhere between teaching and tutoring and the creation of Diana's Education, you found time to write three books.
Today,
which is kind of amazing. So Don't Count Me Out, A Guide to Better Grades and Test Scores for Pre-K through 12 is one book. The next one, Grade Transformer for the Modern Student Early High School Education. And then the one that I'd like to talk about in a bit more detail today is Grade Transformer for the Modern Student Upper High School Edition. So clearly you're saying that for each of these sort of developmental areas, there are perhaps different ways to approach their learning.
Absolutely, because as a student, you know, climbs that ladder of academics and grade, and goes from grade level to grade level, of course the teaching and the expectations become more sophisticated. The curriculum demands, you know, increase greatly, and there's more concepts taught. And therefore, the student is expected to perform at a higher level every single year. And so what I would teach my students is, in every year, we have to reassess and change some of these study systems that you have, some of the organizational systems, some of the listening systems that you're using for class, and they need to be reassessed, and we need to step them up. And sometimes you have to even step them up every single semester as the curriculum demands increase. And so to use the ones that maybe they used in middle school or even in the early high school level, they probably need to reassess and start adding more to the study plan that they're using. And most students, what I found, they don't always realize that.
Yeah.
They think, well, I used this last year and it worked, but they don't always get, because their brains are not functioning at an adult level yet, that they need to continue to reassess, re-implement, and add more to their study systems and add more sophisticated methods.
Well, and children aren't the only folks who will often think if it worked, you know, 10 years ago, then it's got to work now, even if they have evidence to the contrary. But that's another conversation as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Barbara, we're going to take a break in a moment. But when we come back, as I said, I really would like to focus on Grade Transformer for the Modern Student Upper High School Education. And also, just before we take the break, when you talk about students with dyslexia, ADD, ADHD, are there other kinds of disabilities that your work is appropriate for?
Yes.
What are they?
Oh, okay. They are kids who have any type of, you know, learning differences, which can be into the verbal and communication learning differences.
Okay.
And we know the speech and language areas, because I have a certificate in that area as well. And it can also be for a highly functioning autistic children.
Okay,
and
so
I have taught several highly functioning autistic kids.
So there's a broad range that your work and your approaches are appropriate for. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue with Barbara Dianis, who is an educational powerhouse. That's the title I'm giving her. And she is also the author of Grade Transformer for the modern student. The upper high school education is the one we're going to focus on today. But as you heard me say, there are two other books that she actually has written that are available to folks. So this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back, folks. I'm Pamela Brewer, and I am continuing the conversation with Barbara Dianis. Barbara, before we go into more detail with the book, the last book that you've written, I am wondering what you would recommend to parents and students with respect to disclosing a disability or a learning difference that they may have to the school. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, my thoughts about it are that if they feel comfortable letting the school know, that if the school understands that there is an actual diagnosis from some sort of, you know, testing clinic or another school, their school system or whatever, that it will help the teachers understand how to help them. When they understand that, you know, they might need to give some more accommodations to a student, might place them in the front of the classroom, or maybe check to make sure they're getting their notes down and just do smaller checks and balances to make sure that they're doing their part to help the student. Most teachers are more open to that, especially if they understand that there has been a diagnosis, and they can help, that can help make them part of the process where the student really can help become all they can be and reach their educational potential. But if the teachers left in the dark and the school's left in the dark and they know there's something maybe not happening for this student academically is where they should be, and there might be some issues with that student academically, then they might be starting the writing them up to have them assessed when maybe it's already been done. And therefore there's precious time being lost in some cases, and also the implementation of maybe some new strategies may not be happening. And also the teacher will be more understanding if they know there is a diagnosis.
All right. So would you recommend that parents actually provide teachers with educational material about the diagnosis, or is it reasonable to assume that the teacher is aware?
Well, it's not reasonable to believe that they're aware, because most cases they have so many students that they're teaching.
Okay.
Or even if they have a class of 30, you know, of 28 students or 25 students,
it's a lot.
They're not always aware that there is some sort of diagnosis. Therefore, I think if the parent feels comfortable, they, you know, bring in the testing and the results from doctor testing clinics or whatever, and let them know what's going on, and really make them aware, because they might be thinking it's one diagnosis, it is entirely different.
Exactly.
Because I had a few cases where, you know, before the students, when they were placed with me, before they had their testing, I would have said, this is the diagnosis. And it was really came back surprising, because there are some students who can surprise you with it, no matter how many kids you've taught, and have a different diagnosis than what you thought. So I think it's just very important to keep those channels of communication open when the parent feels it's appropriate.
One of the things that you say early on is that test taking means something profoundly different, perhaps even terrifying, to the student who learns differently than from the student who learns in the traditional manner. What did you mean by that?
Well, so often, like this happened in my life, and this also happened in, you know, with the students that I taught, where you'd study for the test, they'd go to the test and say nothing, couldn't recall much of anything, say nothing I studied was on the test, not being able to identify that information, and not do well on the test, and become very defeated and think, well, I just studied, you know, 5 hours for a test, and I have a D or, you know, C minus or whatever grade they might get. That isn't what they expected. So test taking can become a very negative experience for kids. And some of them actually develop test taking anxiety because they have such a difficult time sitting down and being able to process the information, the way the questions are asking, and then determine which is the correct answer. And some of them put so much pressure on themselves that they can actually impede their test-taking ability because of the anxiety levels that might reach a real heightened levels because they had not done well in the past.
Would you say that it's important for parents to focus less on the test score and more on the student's efforts, or no? Or both?
Well, how I address it is with the students, I will say, okay, let's take a look at the test. First of all, if it's available, let's go over what you did right and what you did wrong. Because so often they need to have things literally pointing out to them. Sometimes it can be just learning the wording of tests, because one little word can change the whole way that question is being asked. And students don't always innately, especially if they're struggling in school, key into those little slight changes in words. And then what I would say to them, okay, let's try some new test-taking study ways, such as you're going to be drilled on the test information in two different ways. One, you're going to answer to me, we're going to go over it, and you're going to give me some verbal answers, but you're going to also write some of it on like a whiteboard or whatever. And I found with the students, when they had to answer verbally and then write even part of the answer, they retained the information more and did much better on tests.
Interesting.
And I would just say, let's set some small goals. Let's just take some small goals here. Let's look at your, okay, maybe you scored a 68 on this test. Let's see, in the next unit, we're going to start early. We're going to prepare every day. Few minutes a day, maybe 5 extra minutes relearning, so your brain has time to take that information and file it in a place that it will be able to access it easily, and also you'll be able to take that learning and transfer it from the short term to the long term much easier. And so let's start doing some new things. And how many points do you think you can score better? I would say, if you got a 68, let's look if we can get to a 75 or 72. So I wouldn't make the goals unreachable for the kids.
Okay.
I'd add so many points, and they'd say, yeah, I think I can do that. And what I've found through my students is through helping them learn new ways to take tests, new ways to analyze the test questions, and starting early enough, they would be able to achieve that goal. So they may have moved up maybe 5-10 points, but those were big, big hurdles for them.
Absolutely.
And then the next test, we'd say, okay, you moved up 5 points. Let's see if we can go up another 5 points. And then soon they were doing very well, but it took, you know, it was a process of baby steps. And they also saw their own ability increase, and their anxieties then actually would decrease in what I found.
You point out that not only is test taking an art, but that test questions are written to actually test, to trick the test taker. So
they can be.
That's a little anxiety provoking in and of itself. What's that about?
Well, what I found, you know, when I was a student also in school, I was so literal. I just thought if I learned the definition, learn this formula or that formula, all the questions were going to be asked identical to what I learned. And I myself was shocked to find out that wasn't the case. And I would teach that to the kids. They would think that they were so literal as well, where they would think, well, it should be exactly how it's written or whatever, or they didn't think it was, the question was anything remotely close to what they learned. And so I would teach the kids that they want, that test, whoever's making up these tests, whether it's your teacher or they're ones that are being made up by other companies, that part of their goal is that you learn to apply the information and take it a step further from what you just learned, rotely, or just learned the definition. So you've got to understand, you have to really analyze those questions. And that always came as a shock to the kids. And they were always very surprised when I taught them that whole concept, because they were looking for everything to be done exactly how they learned it. And so many of them, especially as they went up in school, you find so much more application skills are necessary to help the student find what the real answer is.
One of the recommendations that you make, which if I think about it, makes tons of sense, but I think a lot of people don't think about it. It's very simple. It's very clear. Read the question twice. Take your time and read the question twice. Why is that so important? Is it for the same reasons you just discussed?
Absolutely. It's the same reasons, because you do want to read it twice so that you really know, is this asking what I think it's asking? What I found with a lot of kids, and even my own situation, so often kids think that test taking is almost a contest to whoever can finish first must do the best. And they're very aware of what their peers are doing as far as if they're starting to turn in the tests, and they become anxiety-ridden from just watching other people get up and turn in their tests or whatever. And what I've found with my kids is, and even myself, I would be rushing myself to try to keep up with, well, gee, it shouldn't be taking me this long. And I would find myself rushing too much and missing a word or not seeing that one key concept that that would totally change the question. And so I would teach my students, and I still teach them, to slow down, really read those questions twice, because the first time your brain may have missed a word. Make sure you're reading it word for word. Test taking is not a contest in speed. If you're the last person to turn in the test, that's fine. Just because someone turned it in first doesn't mean they're going to get an A. Okay. That they would miss, when they went back and really relooked at the questions and looked at it slowly, and even the answers slowly more than once, they would pick up maybe the word that changed that whole question that they missed the first time, they might self-correct the second time. And so that's why it is so important to read the questions more than once.
You know, that's advice, and actually I think could do well for everybody, anybody.
Oh, absolutely.
Is to not speed through the question.
Absolutely. And to really spend time, and then also what I would teach the kids is read back your answer with the question to really make sure that answer fits and makes sense. Because again, you might pick something, and then when you read it together, back with the question and the answer together, you might find it didn't fit, and you can self-correct and find some of your mistakes that way as well.
I also noticed that you break the learning strategies down by month. Why is that?
Because during my teaching, I would find, because I've spent so many years in the classroom, that in the very beginning, August, September, depending on where the school systems begins in the area they're at, they'd be doing more review, there'd be less homework, but the curriculum was really reviewing the year before. And then as you got into the fall months, the curriculum started to speed up. And then by the time you were around winter break area, the curriculum was really speeding up. And as soon as you got back from winter break, the curriculum was at its full speed and continuing. And so it was that acceleration that caused me, because every month I would have to say to my students, okay, this is a new month. We need to keep moving more. The pace is going to keep moving up. This is what you need to do to keep pace with the accelerating curriculum. So that's why I break it down month to month, because even with the strategies they may have used at the beginning of the school year or the first semester, they need to beef them up for the second semester and add more to it.
Interesting. I think that's important learning for the parents or the caregivers as well, that it really does require taking a look at what they're doing month to month. But there's one month that I got to ask you about in particular. You mm-hmm. have particular strategies for December. And for December, so many people are involved in a range of holiday and or year-end yes. observances. The kids don't want to do anything but not be in school.
That's true. That's why I have a real set schedule for that month, because there's so many extra things, you know, extra holidays and extra activities happening around that month. And for students, especially those who have learning challenges or ADD and dyslexia or whatever, it's easy for them to get so wrapped up in all these other activities, which are wonderful, but they forget their studies. And that's what I noticed with my students, is they'd be so wrapped up in all of that, which is one, like I said, they're great activities, but they have to realize that, yes, you still have to study. You still are probably going to have some exams that you need to be ready for, and you need to keep working so that you're not surprised. And then you forgot your homework, and it snowballs into, oh my gosh, now I'm in a panic stage. Am I going to, you know, pass the class, or I have my grade just dropped because I didn't turn in my homework because I've been doing all these other activities and I didn't focus. So I really stress in putting down on the calendar all the other activities and then working your study time and homework time into that changing calendar and making sure you're still adhering to all of the things you need to do for school as well.
So you're inside of that, you're also teaching planning and organizational skills, which are critical for everyone to learn.
Right. Absolutely. Because you have to, even if you have other activities, that doesn't make the other responsibilities you have, such as school, go away and all of those responsibilities. So I really stress that with the kids.
So it sounds like you're saying that learning is a year-round experience, including summers, including vacations, including holidays. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that doesn't mean they never take a break, because that's not realistic.
Okay.
What I'm saying is, you know, they have to keep pace at whatever it is that they're, you know, if they're just on a break, they might need to go back and spend a few minutes reviewing information that they maybe not had done as well in, because learning builds on itself and curriculum spiral around. So therefore, if they would, you know, maybe dedicate 15, 20 minutes during an actual break, going just to go back over their notes, go back over and work on areas that maybe were more challenging to them that they really didn't master, can be very helpful and help them become the student they need to be. And during the summertime, that is so important for students, not to just say, school's out, throw the books away, I'm done, I don't have to think about this till the fall semester begins, because they will, according to the Graham study in 2006, they will degress up to 2 to 3 months in their learning for those who don't do anything. And if they're struggling in school anyway, summer's a great time to implement, you know, 30 minutes a day or an hour a day, depending on what the student's needs are, to go back and relearn some information that maybe wasn't mastered, go back over the hard concepts, go back over even the concepts they thought they really had mastered, and then just keep working on maybe pre-learning some fall concepts that they will be learning. And they can, you know, take that and maybe do 15 minutes 4 times a day if that works for them, or, you know, 20-minute intervals. It really doesn't matter. It's just that they keep reading, learning, and achieving to keep their minds fresh, and so that they don't lose the learning that they learned during the school year, and that they go back to school with their brains still being active learning.
And when you talk about breaking it down into intervals, 15, 20-minute intervals, I mean, it certainly sounds very doable and not at all daunting.
It's extremely doable. And my students, when they would balk about it, because I put every one of them, I'd sit down with their parents and put every one of them on some sort of summer learning program. But when they got into it and it was only 15 minutes here and there, it might be 15 minutes you read, 15 minutes you go back over concepts in one, and I would actually schedule, you know, this, you know, maybe Monday you work on English, Tuesday you work on some math or whatever, however, whatever worked for the student. They found the 15 minutes flew by, and it wasn't the, they still had all the time for their other activities or jobs or sports or whatever clubs they were in, and that they were learning and progressing and hanging on to that learning, but the time didn't seem like it was really much of anything.
And I can see those students actually re-entering school feeling a lot less anxious about their own ability to function in the school environment because they've continued throughout the break.
Right, and some of them would grow up to, you know, the way certain school systems tested the children's abilities, you know, some more informally when they started in the fall. And some of them would have improved a half year to a year in their scholastics just by keeping up every day for, you know, just short periods of time. It really paid off for the kids. And the ones that did some pre-learning when they started to learn in their classrooms and they were hearing lectures, they had information that they could build upon, and they weren't hearing the information for the first time. Therefore, they retained more information from the class instructions, and the lectures made more sense to them. And they ended up with the rewards of understanding the class or the concept so much better.
Absolutely. And so, again, you're giving us a whole different way to conceptualize the process of learning. Mm-hmm. Barbara, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. This is Pamela Brewer, folks. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Barbara, I noticed that you say that homework should not be an all-evening endeavor. I think I'm quoting you. Now, I read that, I think about that, and I certainly think about the many parents who agree with you that a child shouldn't have to spend all evening doing homework, so the parent will do it. What's your thought about that? Is
well,
that
the
alternative?
Doing the homework is defeating the purpose.
Okay, so that's not the alternative.
That is not the alternative at all, because the student has to learn the concepts themselves. The parent probably already did or can brush, but that's not the idea at all. The idea is most curriculums really look at, depending on what year the student is in school, having, you know, when they're very young, maybe 30 minutes to 45 minutes a day of homework. And by the time they're in high school, an hour, hour and a half-ish, and 2 hours really maximum. And what most parents find with their kids, if they're, certainly if they're ADD, ADHD, or struggling in school, they will sit there for hours and hours and hours to perform a homework assignment that should take maybe 15, 20 minutes. They might sit there with it for over an hour because they're maybe not focused, they don't know what to do, they might be, you know, sort of attending but not really.
Maybe they're anxious.
And so, yes. And so therefore what I used for my students, and I taught the parents of my students to do, and it became very effective, is to go over their homework with them when you have a set homework time. You know, that needs to flex. If there's, you know, sports or their activities, but make sure it's a certain amount of time each day after school, sometime before they go to bed. And then sit down with them and say, okay, let's look at what your assignments are. And so often now, you know, if they don't have a place to write it down or don't write their assignments down, a lot of them are available online where the parents, they can get into this teacher's online information and find out what that assignment is. And therefore, they can take the assignments and say, okay, let's really look at this. Let's look at this English sheet. How long should this take for you to do? If we go over the instructions, I think this should probably take, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And I would have them just write in lightly in pencil 20 minutes or whatever. And let's see how close you can come. We're going to go over the information, go over the instructions together, and let's see how close you can come to actually, you know, achieving this and getting this particular assignment done in the allotted time. You know, when I set those goals, or the parents set those goals with the kids and help them keep pace, and then they can go and do whatever they need to do and check in with the child or the teenager every so often and say, okay, where are you at on this? And if they're just sitting, say, okay, read this question to me out loud, you know, or go over this with me for a minute. Let's see why you haven't really done anything. And you might even put a timer to help them keep pace. And what I found is as the kids learned to pace themselves through the homework, the parents spent some time going back over the directions and just reading the directions with them and then checking to make sure they were continuing to follow the directions, it made homework so much easier over time. It doesn't mean it was magically corrected in one night, but over time, those homework issues became less and less, where students were learning how to break down their assignments and how to keep themselves paced through it. And so I would tell the students, well, if your homework should take 45 minutes, if you're going to spend 2.5 hours on it, you are, you know, look at the time that you're sitting and not doing, and that's all time that you could be doing other activities with. And as over time, the kids got that. And they started to keep pace, and they started to want to achieve their homework in more reasonable amounts of time. But again, if the student doesn't understand the directions or needs a little bit of reteaching or preteaching, that's fine. But the idea is not for the parent to do the homework for them at all.
And it sounds like you're also saying that the parent needs to walk away and let the child do it him or herself, not sit there and do it or monitor it.
Well, now, that's in most cases. Now, if you have a student who really has so much reading issues that still need to be remediated and are having trouble reading the questions, then that would be a different issue.
Okay. But at no time should the parent actually do the child's homework for the child.
No. Okay. Not in my opinion.
Okay.
No. That is not teaching the child. It is defeating the purpose of homework. The purpose of homework is to practice a skill and concept they've learned and reinforce it.
The complaint that I hear from many, sometimes students, sometimes parents, sometimes teachers, is this notion of teaching to the test versus actually teaching, quite frankly, the child and teaching the concepts. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, how I've always addressed that with the kids and with it, whether they're younger kids or teenagers, I would say, you know, what you really have to take away is the core objectives. What are the curriculum objectives that you need to learn so that you've mastered the material you need to master to go on to the next level of school? That is what you need to concentrate on. And sometimes, you know, if it's relearning, you know, which questions and things are going to be emphasized on that test, then you need to really work on that, not just to learn for the test, but you've got to work on learning those concepts, because behind those questions there are core learning concepts that need to be mastered. And focus on the idea that you are working toward mastering core learning concepts that are needed for your life and education.
So what I hear is a focus on what the student can do, not what the student cannot do.
Absolutely. And that's how I taught my students. I would say, okay, we're going to look at your strengths and weaknesses. every student has strengths and weaknesses, no matter who you are. You know, you have your son that, you know, can ace every test and get through school just fine, but for the rest of us. And I would just say there are strengths and weaknesses. And I would say, you know, we're going to use those strengths to bring up those weaknesses. We're not going to just focus on your weaknesses. We're going to look at what do you do well? You know, are you a good reader? Can you comprehend well? Can you take good notes? And even if there are things that they're not doing well, let's find ways to help bring some of these weaknesses into strengths. And let's teach you how to comprehend more of what you're reading and jot down some notes that are, you know, going to be more in keeping with the concepts the teacher is trying to teach, not just more random facts, because sometimes kids, especially who are ADD, will bring out the more random facts and focus on those versus the more relevant material. And I would say, let's teach you how to do this. Let's go through and reread that paragraph and 2-3 times until you can at least tell me back 3 concepts that you remember, so that you're not just reading, getting to the end of the page and retaining very little because your mind wasn't focusing. Let's find ways and strategies to help you focus on the material and help you learn and help you bring those weaknesses up into some strength areas.
You talk about encouraging the students to use their own resources. Is that what you mean?
Well, if they need to, absolutely. What I would find with my students is they might be reading about, for instance, the parts of a cell. And the particular textbook they have may have a small little picture that they really, in black and white or sort of in color, and they really can't tell what pieces of the part of the cell really are. And they might become very confused on that type of concept. So what I would say is don't be afraid to go to the internet. You know, type in, you know, cellular functions or cellular material, and go to the internet and see what's there. Or find another source that maybe explain the same concept in words that you understand better. And I say that is when they're, you know, hitting a brick wall and finding a concept that they feel like they just can't quite understand, can't quite get. And if they get to that point, don't just give up. Mm-hmm. Find another source that might be more in keeping to the way you learn, might have more pictures or diagrams that will speak to you and help you understand the concept differently than maybe what the text or the teacher presentation or notes is giving you.
So I also hear a creative approach to learning. Don't feel stuck to learn this one way because that's what the teacher said. Don't ignore what the teacher said, but allow yourself to expand your learning options.
Absolutely. And I found when I did that, talk to my students about expanding their learning options, they learned so much better and then go back to the text. And the text always made more sense to them when they had some details filled in, maybe at a little bit lower vocabulary level or used other information or charts and graphs and pictures and maybe some interactive. Some of the sites have some interactive games that they can play, learning the parts of the cell, for instance, or other areas. And that helped them to understand if they didn't get the source the first time, there are many other ways to teach and to be able to learn a concept.
What I hear continually throughout our conversation today is to look at the individual and to look at what they are able to do, to notice what they have difficulties with, but not be stopped by that, neither the parent or the student, or quite frankly, the teacher.
Absolutely, because I've seen some, you know, very, very significant diagnosis of students that I was told, you know, by what the testing said, that these students would never really achieve academically, and they have. Over time, using different methods and approaches and some patience and really working new strategies, they did learn. And so that, to me, is the biggest encouragement, is to see the ones that maybe perhaps look like they wouldn't do well. I had one in particular was referred to me when he was in third grade. He wasn't reading, and the outside testing said he wouldn't probably read. And I just looked at, you know, I respectfully looked at the testing and said, you know, please, you know, hand me my copy of it and we'll get back with you. And not only did he read, he just graduated a very highly demanding university with an MBA.
Wow. So the work that you do has really got to feel wonderful for you. It sounds like you're impacting so many lives.
Well, it's wonderful to see the kids reach their potential and to be able to learn anyway and to be able to go on and live lives that they want to live and not let these learning issues stop them. And that, to me, has been one of my greatest goals in life, is to spread the word that kids can learn.
And again, to encourage parents that they can actually help their child in ways
right.
that are truly helpful, to help that child blossom in ways that neither the parent or the child may, or some of the test results may have predicted.
That's correct. Absolutely.
Barbara, what are some ways for folks to get more information about the work that you do?
Well, they can go to my website, which is www.dianis, which is D-I-A-N-I-S, just Diane with an S, education.com. I'm also on Twitter under Barbara Dianis. They can also go to my Facebook page, which is Barbara Dianis, and many of my articles that I have written for various sources are readily available with all kinds of tips.
All right, and just again, spell the full address for your website.
It's Dianis, D-I-A-N-I-S, with the word education.
All right, D-I-A-N-I-S, education.com. And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.